Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first episode of the Must See Matches podcast. My name is Kieran Laporte, and I'm joined by the mastermind behind the Must See Matches project. That is Mark Buckledy. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. I'm really up for it on this first of what should be an interesting endeavour.
I don't know where to start. Should we like kind of introduce and explain what the project is first?
Yeah. So the best way to sum up the creation of the project was I saw something on Twitter and decided to make an awful lot of work for myself. I was inspired by a conversation I saw on Twitter, and I'll give a quick shout out to Strigger and B. McCooley. And it was about the old series of books you used to get, like 1,000 albums to listen to before you die.
Ah, yeah.
And I was thinking about that, and that got me thinking about wrestling. And when it comes to wrestling projects, you see a lot of projects about the greatest match ever, or the best wrestler ever, or greatest wrestler ever. And a lot of those projects are basically, it becomes very focused on like the best of the best. And I wanted something where I specifically wanted to crowdsource it, but anyone could join. And I wanted the widest, most varied list possible.
Yeah, we should say that like must see doesn't necessarily mean good.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the reasons I specifically said must see. I didn't say best. I didn't say greatest. I didn't even say favorite, because I wanted to see all this variety, and I wanted to get as many people possible doing it. So we've got some matches that are like the best. You know, there are matches there that people would generally say are up there with the best, but there's also matches that are either for a personal emotional value, or for a, there's something special about it in terms of a uniqueness, or it's something that focuses on one aspect of wrestling. So we've got an incredible amount of variety on this list.
Yes. So we should probably talk about what we're intending to do with this podcast. If you don't know who either of us are, we do a monthly podcast called DD Teach, which is about the wild and wacky world of the DDT promotion in Japan. And then I had some time on my hands and kind of came on board to help Mark double check your work to start with, really, I guess, like be a second pair of eyes to like filter out duplicates and that kind of stuff.
It started out like that, and then towards the end, essentially, you were doing a Columbo impersonation.
I did become kind of like internet wrestling detective. I have seen so much terrible Japanese indie wrestling in buildings that should not have wrestling, sometimes without a ring involved. I have watched French stuff from the 50s. I have tried to track down... if Tommy Rich was actually in Puerto Rico on a particular day in 1987. I had a week or two of this. It's actually quite fun. I love practical problem solving and that kind of thing and that kind of detective work. So it was actually quite a lot of fun.
And for me, I'm a guy that leans towards sort of data nerdism. So even before this project, I would randomly decide, like on a whim, it's like, oh, I'm just going to check what the attendance for Sumo Hall has been for the last 10 years for some completely pointless reason. So doing a project where you get to see all of this data and all of these matches and all of these recommendations was really interesting to me. And I want to thank you for all the work that you did, because it's the kind of stuff that I would have found an absolute pain in the backside.
It's quite funny how we each enjoy things the other one doesn't in that kind of respect. And that's kind of worked really well when it came to putting together the spreadsheet. So the point of kind of doing this show is we want to talk about like the top, what the stuff that finished towards the top of the list. The spreadsheet itself has, is it 1,065 unique nominations on it? Unique matches nominated?
Yeah, it's about 1,065.
Yeah. And we put a cutoff point for this show of matches that it's kind of a weird number. It's two lots of weird numbers. Matches that finished with more than 4.5% of the vote, which leaves us with 104 matches. And if we're doing one a week, which is the plan, essentially we've just made a 2-year podcast commitment and we have to not fall out until mid 2024. So that's the idea. Every week we're going to take one of these matches and we will do them in, I've been calling them silos. The 4.5% silo, the next silo up is the 5 and a bit percent, then 6.25%, then 7, then 8, and so on. And that corresponds to kind of like number of votes corresponds to the percentage. And we were going to be tackling them silo by silo. So the next, I don't know how many weeks of podcasts, is just the 4.5%ers. We're not going to tackle the match that finished first for 2 years as of this date. And that's assuming we do one a week and don't miss any. So we've set ourselves, I mean, this is a smaller task than the sheet itself and gathering all of that information. Mm. And it's not like we're covering all 1,065 matches, but this is still quite a sizable project we've set ourselves just with this show.
Yeah. What did I tell you at the very start? I decide something that leads to an awful lot of work on a win.
Just picking away at that little thing that you think, yeah, it's not going to be much. And then it ends up being much. So we do have a match to talk about on this show. It's not going to be just two blokes talking about a spreadsheet. And we are planning for as many episodes as possible, hopefully all of them, to get a guest who nominated the match on to talk about why it made their list, how it makes them feel, and what they were thinking of when they wrote it down. Were you surprised? Was there anybody you were surprised didn't get a nomination? Is there anybody like you would think they would have at least one match on this list and didn't?
The big one for me was Yoshihashi. No, seriously. I don't think there was anyone. I mean, I looked at the usual suspects and
yeah,
there wasn't anyone that really stood out. I think for me, one of the interesting things was seeing Tomohiro Ishii only having 8 matches on the list. Because if you think about, like, if you go
and by
year
the list,
by
you
year,
mean the full 1,000?
The full 1,066.
Wow.
Ishii only has 8, and at least one of them is a pre-New Japan 2001 DDT show, I think.
Wow.
So if you think about how many years, like in the match of the year kind of rankings that or the G1s, how often Tomohiro Ishii is listed, and he only has 7 matches from that peak period, and at least one is a RevPro match. So, which is,
and only as I'm looking now, only one of them we're going to talk about on this show.
Yeah,
he only appears in the top 104 once.
And I think it kind of gives a good example that this list, I think if it's a wrestler that just puts in consistently very good to great matches, I don't think they're going to show up as much as people that have less frequency, but when either the highs hit or there's a more of an emotional connection, it's like Ishii's almost too consistently good.
Yeah, he has a consistently high floor, doesn't he? He doesn't peak and trough like a lot of people. I mean, you could say someone like Kazuchika Okada has a high floor, but when he peaks, he really peaks.
Yeah. And yeah, he is someone that you'll see a lot more on this podcast.
Yeah. Were there people, I mean, this is chucking people under the bus, were there people you were surprised to see get nominated? For example, I will go first and get myself in trouble first, possibly. I didn't expect to see Brandon Cutler and Danny Doring and Roadkill make this list. Not the podcast list, but the 1,000. Yeah.
There were some names. I didn't expect 3 Kaito Yano matches, I can tell you that.
I'd never heard of him until I had to research him faffing about in a gym with his mates on a mat.
Yeah. I didn't expect 2 Nasty Boys matches.
Well, I mean, I'm going to pull back the curtain a bit. I voted for one of them. One of my favorite matches of all time includes the Nasty Boys. It's not going to make the podcast. because it didn't get enough nominations. But one of my favorite matches is a Nasty Boys match.
But the funny thing is both Nasty Boys matches took place within like a 2 month period.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, which means I know what the other one is without even thinking about it. Yeah.
Oh, other ones that stood out, Robbie Brookside. I mean, I get that there's people that really appreciate him, but I would have expected a lot more wrestlers of that era to have been picked before him. I didn't expect a Giant Baba versus Jumbo Tsuruta cosplay match.
Bill DeMott made the list. There's a Crash the Terminator match on the list.
Bobby Quant. I'm not saying Bobby Quant is a bad wrestler, but it's not a name that you hear of a lot.
Andy Kaufman is on the list twice, and he's officially, in air quotes, not a wrestler.
Yeah. The last one is Haruka Igen, and prime Haruka Igen. I'm talking 2000s Haruka.
Yeah, newspapers and spitting Haruka Igen. Yeah. So, like, I found myself in a weird kind of world of trivia when it came to looking stuff up. Like, would you believe me if I told you Toshiaki Kawada once wrestled on the same card as Bobby Heenan? That kind of thing. It wasn't nominated, and it's just something I found that was on a show with a match that did get nominated. There was what Battle Arts once did Hawk and Animal against Alexander Otsuka and Muhammad Yone.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware of the Road Warriors in Battle Arts.
Yeah.
Ability.
I discovered there are two Yuki Ishikawas.
Oh, you weren't aware of that?
No, I don't dig around in the gutters of Japanese indie
How
pro wrestling very often.
How dare you call 2008 Big Japan a gutter?
Yeah. So that kind of thing was interesting to me. Did you find any kind of like weird trivia?
There's one that stood out. So recently we did, me and Kieran guested on a podcast with Alan Forel over on Pro Wrestling Paradise on PW Torch. And that was all about Corican Hall. And Alan was surprised that only 3 matches in the top 104 took place in Corican. The bit that I liked, over 10% of this list took place in Corican.
Yeah.
There are over 100 matches from Corican on this list. And
as we mentioned on that show with Alan, you know, the whole point of that show, Corican Hall is a special place.
Mm. It just showed, I think it showed both how regularly the big guys ran there, how many promotions ran there in total, and how many of the smaller guys treated it as this is where we put on, you know, this is where we take it seriously. This is where we put on our good stuff.
Absolutely. It's the hardest of the hardcore fans in Japan, not just in Tokyo. You know, it's the 2000 hardest core wrestling fans in the country, I guess. Or, you know, or within, you know, a Yamanote line train of Corican Hall. I'm going to quickly do not the serious bit. It's kind of the disclaimer and the disclosure. So Mark and I both submitted lists. Mark in charge of the project obviously would have seen other people's nominations, and I would assume did try not to let them affect his own nominations. I didn't see anybody else's nominations, and in fact submitted my list before I became involved in this project. We've used Cage Match as our primary source for information, and you would, wouldn't you? You know, it can't be overstated what a great resource that is. It is, however, not infallible. Sorry, Strigger. And we used WrestlingData.com, John Lister's ITVWrestling.co.uk, The Greatest Matches Ever Project Board, Wrestling Observer, YouTube, Daily Motion, and Archive.org, and probably some other sources as well, to fill in some blanks, kind of verify information, and sometimes just confirm that matches actually happened. There is one Japanese women's match that I'm still not convinced happened despite finding it on 2 different tape trader lists and the Greatest Matches Ever project. I don't think these two ever wrestled. But that's kind of like, you know, the disclaimer part of the show, I guess.
Well, that's out the way. Do you think it's time to talk about the match?
Yes, and we've chosen this match specifically because it's the shortest match on the list and we can get it I mean, we could do all of the intro stuff and talk about this match. Like, it's not a 30-minute draw. I'm going to spoil that right now. The match we're going to talk about today, as you will have seen from the thumbnail, hopefully, and the description, is Kenta versus Ricky Marvin from Pro Wrestling Noah at Corican Hall on October the 15th, 2009. I hadn't seen this until an hour ago.
I have... So I've seen this. I peeked behind the curtain. I nominated this match, and I've seen this a few times. I saw it a couple of months ago, actually, and that was one of the things that made me want to put it on, was actually rewatching it and just realizing, yeah, this is the kind of thing that belongs on this list, and I'll tell you why a bit later on.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is exactly the kind of match that belongs on this list. It is, I mean, I called it the birth of the Marvin sprint, but it isn't really. He'd not done it to this degree up until this point.
If it's okay, I'm just going to jump in with a little bit of context for this match.
Yeah, go first. Go for it. I did some research, but you go for your life.
So this was the first day of Noah's first ever singles junior tournament. It was also the only singles junior tournament Noah did till 2015, so they never made it a regular.
So this one must have gone great.
Yeah, it was a 10-man tournament with two blocks, and it had a mix of a lot of the bigger names, some of the younger guys, and Delirious.
Yeah, so... Ricky Marvin's next match in this tournament was 1 week later. It went 14 minutes and he lost to Delirious.
So Kenta is a guy, I've forgotten how many times we're going to talk about him on the podcast, but there's at least one cracking match that I know he's got. And I mean, at this point in his career, Kenta's a three-time GHC junior champion. He's a two-time junior tag champion. He's already had two title matches for the heavyweight title. So Kenta is essentially the guy to beat in the block.
Yeah.
And Ricky Marvin, now, Ricky Marvin had been in Noah since 2003. He's one of the regular foreign wrestlers in Noah. He'd never beaten Kenta in a singles match at this point.
And never has.
Spoilers.
As far as I could find out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, never has from what I can see on Cage Match.
Yeah, yeah, they've had, as far as I saw, they've had five singles matches. Kenta's won all of them. Their previous singles match to this was in June 2009, and that went 27 minutes. So you can imagine how much of a shock this was to anybody who had seen that previous match.
Yeah. So we've kind of suggested that this goes short. Shall we say... exactly how short this goes?
According to the commentator at the end of the match, it's 1 minute and 59 seconds.
Yep. It is an absolute sprint. Yeah. Absolute.
Yeah. And Marvin had done kind of not this lot, this condensed before, but I was having a look and he'd done a lot of 3 to 7 minute stuff, like here in Toriumon and in Michinoku Pro beforehand. I did find one Ricky Marvin singles match that's shorter than this, where he got battered by Takeshi Morishima in 1 minute 42 seconds 2 years later. And I've seen a Marvin sprint live. I was in Corican Hall about a year after this with Marvin and Nakajima going about 4.5 minutes. And that was a shock on that. I've watched it back since. It's not as good as I remembered it being live. Like this, they somehow managed to have a lull in a 4.5 minute match, which I didn't remember from live. Probably because I was catching my breath at the time. But it's still good. It's still like, you know, it's worth 5 minutes of your time for sure. And what a great gimmick to have, especially in Noah, right? Mm. Instead of getting your collar starched for 30 minutes, be the guy who comes in, has an exciting sub-5-minute match that everyone will remember and get paid the same as if you'd gone 30. What a great gig.
Oh, yeah. I'll come up on this a little bit later, but if this match went 15 minutes, no one probably would have nominated it.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think we'd be talking about it. I'm sure it would have been great. Ricky Marvin versus Kenta for 15 minutes sounds like it's probably a really good match. But I don't. You're right. It would have been another Noah Juniors match, and it probably wouldn't have made this show. So, I mean, in talking about how we were going to do this podcast, we said we weren't going to do play-by-play of matches when it came to reviewing them. But with this one, you kind of can, because it's only 2 minutes long. And it's like all the key spots are just backed up against one another. So I'll fill my usual DD Teach role of running through the match, and you jump in as usual whenever you fancy it. Marvin comes out first, and he just rockets into Kenta with this corner to corner tope as he makes his entrance. And I kind of wish Noah has this isometric camera shot that looks corner to corner across the ring whenever they run Corican Hall. And I wish they'd kept that so you could see him run and dive. But this is me. But I should say that my day job is I'm a cameraman and editor. So I will, if there's stuff to beef about in the production, I will beef about it. So instead you get Marvin flying into a handheld shot, and they sort of belatedly cut to that corner to corner shot as he's sort of flopping on Kenta outside the ring. Kenta gets chucked in as the ring announcer is hurriedly trying to get a confused lady with a bunch of flowers out of the ring, which had me howling, and the referee calls for the bell. Marvin immediately smashes Kenta with a John Woo and a powerbomb for a near fall. He then hits a super kick that made me go, ugh, because Kenta's face wobbles and his hair kind of flaps all over the place at the point of impact. He gets kicked right in the cheekbone. It looked so painful. And then Marvin does this amazing sort of feet first duck under a clothesline into an instant kip up that I didn't see coming at all. But that puts him in place to get creamed by a discus lariat.
And just jumping in, there is maybe only a couple of spots I would say are slightly clunky.
Yeah,
this is one of them, and it's the kind of thing in a 50-minute match, no one will really notice this.
Yeah, yeah, it's I think the only reason they mess anything up, and it's not to a massive degree at all, is because they're going so fast.
Oh, they're going in a longer lightning.
They are going lightning fast. Yeah, it's you know, it's half a step behind Masato Yoshino of Dragon Gate. Kenta's on offense. He's flattening Ricky Marvin with a couple of corner drop kicks, but Marvin reverses a go to sleep into a hurricane runner that had all of Corican Hall thinking it was the finish. And we're maybe 45 seconds in, less than a minute maybe. He tries the same reversal again, but Kenta drops forward, and this is one of those ugly spots. He drops forward and folds him with a powerbomb. It looked so painful. Kenta gets in two swinging head kicks at a kneeling Marvin, but Marvin ducks the third and pulls him into a double leg Nelson for another near fall.
That is such a swish spot.
I know. It's perfectly executed. He goes for La Magistral, but Kenta holds onto his leg and his head, shifts his position to get him onto his shoulders, go to sleep, and then just to make sure gives him the old Randy Orton punt in the temple, and then pins him at 1:59. This is exciting stuff. This is a great... This is Noah Goes Nitro.
It's the kind of action that people expect from the Noah Junior division in the 2000s. But it's just incredibly condensed. And Corican were absolutely buzzing for this. The crowd was hot. You could hear them stomping their feet. The pace just did not let up. And it's... Once you see it, it's like it sticks with you.
So I think we would it would probably mean even more if we had seen their match from June, which I definitely haven't. I don't know if you have.
I don't think I have.
Which, as I said, went 25 minutes plus. And so doing it in such a condensed way here, every time somebody went for a pin, the crowd thought that could be the finish. Simply because of the pace. At a slower pace, 20-minute match, you're not going to get that kind of reaction out of people. And I don't know what went on the rest of this show. I haven't looked up the rest of the card. But I guarantee you, everybody walking out of Corican Hall that night was talking about this match.
So the other matches on the card, the other tournament matches were Genba Hironyagi versus Yoshinobu Kanemaru in a double count out. Jushin Liger versus Taiji Ishimori, and a 30-minute draw between Nakajima and Kotaro Suzuki.
Okay. So that, okay, if there was a 30-minute draw on this show, that might explain why they decided to get this one done in two.
Yeah.
Wow. They run this back in Christmas 2012, this time going a whopping 3 minutes and 32 seconds.
The thing that I love about this match is, yes, it's a sprint. Yes, it's all action. It's go, go, go. But it's got a great little story of familiarity. They're essentially telling a story with all these bombs and cradles of Ricky Marvin doesn't believe that he can beat Kenta normally and thinks that he has to win by surprising Kenta.
Yes, he's not trying to wear him down. He's trying to catch him unawares at every opportunity.
He's trying to catch him unawares. And Marvin's failure is when Marvin tries the same trick too many times, because the two turning points are when Marvin goes for the go-to-sleep reversal again and gets caught. And the second one is when Marvin tries one cradle too many and goes for La Magistral, and Kenta's aware of it.
He just holds onto him too tightly, doesn't he? And then manages to shift him around and get his shoulders in the right place to have him up for go to sleep. Yeah. This match is freely available on YouTube. I will include a link in the tweet that accompanies this podcast and in the podcast notes. And that's our first must-see match.
And for me, it's a great example of what I wanted out of the list. I don't think a greatest match ever list is going to include a sub 5 minute sprint. I don't think a lot of projects would, in a lot of lists would include this type of match. And it's a shame, because there is something to say about this kind of match. It's
an under the radar gem. It's not something that's obvious.
There's an art to it, and there's a skill to it that's very different to everything else, and it just clicks.
Absolutely. Alrighty. You can follow this show on Twitter at Must See Matches. You can follow me, if you like, at Kieran Edits. You can follow Mark
at Monkey_Buckles.
Which he gets wrong on every episode of DDTeach. Speaking of which, you can follow that, our other podcast, at DDTeachPod on Twitter. Next week, should everything go according to plan, we will be joined by Ryan Dilbert of Wrestle In to talk about Razor Ramon versus Shawn Michaels, the ladder match from WrestleMania 10, March 20th, 1994. Completely different to the match we've talked about today. And if there's nothing more to add about a 2-minute fast-paced match, we'll say goodbye.
Goodbye.